Concordia University Chicago is committed to keeping college affordable for all, and especially for LCMS Lutherans. We have scholarships available specifically for students who are LCMS members. This is Dr. Russell Dawn, President of Concordia Chicago, asking you to encourage your student to check out Concordia Chicago at cuchicago.edu. And if you are interested in supporting these scholarships, please find us online at foundation@cuchicago.edu.
After my abortion, I felt great relief because the crisis was done. The decision was made. Now I had to try and live with it. It led to a deep pain in my heart that I tried to cover.
You start out with the Bible as God's word, and then you keep your big mouth shut and listen to what it has to say. And if it says something you don't like, tough on you, not tough on the Bible.
I assure you, you are no worse sinner than a Peter who denies Christ three times after standing up and confessing boldly he would never leave him.
Minnesota waterfowlers love listening to Issues, etc.
I am 55 years old, and for longer than I've been alive, I have lived, all of us have lived here in America in an environment that has become increasingly secularized, and never more so than in our public schools. We take for granted that there isn't going to be public money for private schools, and that there's no prayer in schools, and there's no overt religious instruction, depending on how you define religion, in our public schools. But the history of both the funding issue and what can be taught our children in public schools is far more complicated than the last 55 years would indicate. Greetings and welcome back to Issues Etc., coming to you live from the studios of Lutheran Public Radio in Collinsville, Illinois. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. We're going to talk about a Supreme Court case on taxpayer funds for private schools. Joy Pullman of The Federalist will be our guest a little bit later. Molly Hemingway of Fox News will join us for an update on the impeachment trial of President Donald Trump. Joy Pullman is a regular guest. She's managing editor of The Federalist, author of the book The Education Invasion, and a recent column titled Supreme Court to Decide If Atheism Can Keep Its Monopoly on K through 12 Schools. Joy, welcome back.
Hi.
If this case, Espinoza v. Montana Department of Revenue, is decided one way or the other, what could change with regard to schools in the United States?
It all depends on how the Supreme Court decides to rule on a case. And that's not just for or against either side, but also how broadly they decide the case. Usually, of course, the Supreme Court takes up cases with the intent to make a broader statement, you know, about some issue that needs clarity among the lower courts or that has been kind of in arrears for a while. And the people who have brought the case are actually have been pursuing a legal strategy to try to get the Supreme Court not only to rule in the Montana case, but also to rule against, I believe it's 37 states. I'll have to check my facts here. You know, but most of the states in the nation have in their state constitutions a provision like Montana's that prohibits taxpayer dollars from going to, typically the word used is sectarian schools. And so that has been a hindrance to a lot of school choice efforts over the past several decades. And so the folks who have sued to keep going a Montana law allowing a very small program that allowed private donors to give to private schools, they want the Supreme Court not just to say that can continue in Montana, but that in all of these states across the nation, 37 states, the 37 states that have these provisions in their state constitutions, those are in contradiction with the federal constitution and therefore are abolished.
So how did this particular case come about?
So there are these programs called tax credit scholarships. That's just one of a variety of forms of school choice. And they are typically pursued in states like Montana that have these Blaine Amendments because they only deal with allowing people, help making it easier for private donations to fund private schools. So people are probably familiar with the concept of vouchers. That's where state sends direct taxpayer dollars that they, you know, took in taxes from taxpaying people within their state, and they give you know, they send that when a child, you know, chooses a private school instead of a public school, the money that the state set aside to educate that child follows that child. That's called a voucher. But a tax credit scholarship is a different way in which basically on state taxes, people can deduct, you know, a certain amount that the legislature allows. They can take off of their taxes a donation to a private school. That's called the tax credit scholarship. So, for example, I live in Indiana, and we do have a tax credit scholarship program, and my family gives to it. So I think the maximum, you know, deduction is maybe $2,500 for a couple every year. So on our state taxes, you know, if we give, say we give $1,000 to, you know, for a scholarship for a private school, and say our tax bill is $2,000 from our state, then we can take that $1,000 that we gave to the private school and basically put it against our $2,000 state tax bill, and instead we're only paying $1,000 to the state. Our deduction, instead of going to the state, our tax dollars goes to the private school. So that's what Montana had put in place. Montana had a very tiny program. They only allowed people to deduct $150 a year of donations to private schools. But I mean, I guess that, you know, that's better than nothing. But when that law that passed through the legislature and the governor became a law, but the state's Department of Taxation decided that no religious schools were allowed to participate in this program on the grounds that that would be sending money to a sectarian or religious school. And so since, I mean, almost 90% of private schools are religious schools, that basically barred, you know, almost every single school in the state, private school in the state, from using a program set up explicitly for them. And so families who had been planning to use that program to help their children go to private schools sued, and that case has made its way all the way up to the Supreme Court.
Give us this history. It is kind of a lot more complicated than people believe it to be. There was a time, you say, when taxpayer money was funding explicitly religious education and content in public schools.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, from the, you know, before the time of the American founding, since people began making schools in the, you know, the country known as the United States, it actually was the common practice for a school to be set up through the local house of worship. So when people came to settle here from foreign lands, the first buildings that they would build in establishing their settlement, their town, would be typically first the church, and sometimes the church doubled as a meeting hall. And then sometimes the church also doubled or tripled during the week as a school, or, you know, but church, community hall, and school were kind of the three public buildings that tend to be established right away when people were settling the country. And I mean, as you know, listeners in our audience who are Catholic or Lutheran who are aware of their own church histories, it's been for many hundreds of years tradition in both the Lutheran and the Catholic faith traditions for schools and church buildings to go hand in hand. And part of that is just simply practical, you know, because if, you know, it's only been a recent thing that higher education has been something that many people could get. Previously, you know, typically the minister was the most educated person in town. It's him and the doctor. So if you want, you know, to be teaching children something, you know, the minister is the most qualified person anywhere to do that. But it wasn't just because of that practical reason, because the education level of the pastor or the priest, but it was also because our Lutheran listeners will know, and the same thing is true of Catholic churches, you know, both in Christianity itself for many, many, for a long time, it's been part of our history that we see schools and educating children in the Christian faith as an intrinsic part of their catechism, you know, of obeying the biblical injunction to raise your children in the fear and admonition of the Lord. And so, you know, Martin Luther considered schools absolutely essential to, you know, Christian families, to children upbringing, to the work of the church. And so because of that theology and that history, that wasn't just something, again, that Lutherans, Catholics did, you know, folks who are Calvinists, you know, it was just the thing that when you go and you make a settlement, you have a church and you have a school, that is what constitutes public life and government in a community. So from the very beginning, the American colonies and settlements had a tradition of the faith life and the public life of, you know, other communities being mixed together. So, you know, and dependent on the locality, in the southern part of the United States, this was less common than in the north. But again, it was very, very common for public lands, public property, public taxes, and provision to be directed through the church for the education of children. And so the church and the schools were, and the taxing authority worked hand in hand to kind of do this joint religious and public purpose. Nowadays, that's not at all obviously what things are like. And so it seems very different. But again, back to the American founding, you know, very, very large amounts of what we call today K-12 education were run through churches, and it was publicly funded, and everybody thought that was a perfectly normal and appropriate thing to do.
So you had mentioned Blaine amendments. The history of that is also ironic because it's kind of the Protestant anti-Catholic impulse that ended up scrubbing Protestantism out of our schools.
Yes, right. Which I haven't really thought through 100% what I think about this. So, but we'll leave my mental model to one side and just talk about the things that I do know. And so what we do know about these Blaine amendments, to get back to the Montana case, is that right around the time, you know, of course, earliest settlements in America were Protestants. You know, they were a lot of them fleeing religious persecution. The tenor of the American country in the early founding was very much Protestant, and it still is, you know, kind of culturally Protestant. If there is whatever religious influence we have left, it tends to be more Protestant than Catholic. Regardless, you know, there, you know, when waves of immigration from Catholic countries began hitting America, obviously, you know, there were some religious tensions, and there were some very serious religious tensions. I mean, they included, in some cases, you know, riots attacking people, you know, so some of kind of the old world wars of religion definitely had some effects on our shores, although thankfully we haven't had actual wars of religion here. That was something people were trying to get away from. But the Blaine amendments that were put into these 37 state constitutions are predominantly in the Midwest, the central part of the United States, and the West, because they are the ones that were, you know, they were admitted to the Union later. And they were admitted to the Union largely during that time of anti-Catholic settlement. So at that time, the Protestants, I guess you could say even the WASP, they, you know, they were the people who held the political and cultural power in the country predominantly. Obviously, there's exceptions in states like Maryland and Louisiana. But overall, you know, Protestants were in power, and they used that power rather than, and when Catholics said, look, we don't want to read your Protestant Bible in public schools, because that's what was happening. The public schools were basically Protestant religious schools. They would read the Bible. They even sometimes do the catechism. They'd have prayers, very, very large. I mean, if nowadays we looked at a public school of 100, 150 years ago, it would look like a Christian school, you know, to modern eyes. So they put the Catholics, you know, were saying, look, we want to teach our own kids our own faith. You know, we have our own traditions, our own prayers, you know, and even, you know, their own version of the Bible, you know, and they didn't want to do the Protestant things. They want to do the Catholic things. So, but instead of saying, oh, we have this tradition, you know, of letting local tax dollars go to the schools that teach what the parents want, instead, the Protestants tried to shut the Catholics out of public funding for education. And so Blaine Amendments was one way that they did that. But as you mentioned, Todd, what ultimately that, you know, that some people call that bigotry. I mean, that might be bigotry, but that's such a clouded word. I have to really often think about it. That's too loaded of a word for me to want to use and throw around that lightly yet when I haven't done enough thinking about it. But the point being, the discrimination that Protestants used against Catholics was ultimately used against all kinds of Christians to get Christianity completely out of public education by starting in the 1950s.
And it was a cascade of Supreme Court and court decisions that kind of dismantled any kind of religious influence in the public school. So here's the $10,000 question. Does that mean religion has been removed from our public schools? Is the atheism that's taught there religiously neutral?
Well, I don't think so at all. I mean, I think that atheism, secularism, you know, there's kind of a different word for the general same concept. That is a religion. It is it's a belief about the ultimate ends. It's a belief about whether there is a God, what his nature is, whether a man needs to be saved, what human nature is, you know, how salvation occurs. All of those are religious questions that you can't answer empirically through science, and you also can't answer them through your feelings. So you cannot know the truth of religious questions using your senses or your reason. That has to come from revelation. You know, that has to be something. There's a different way of knowing that comes with religion, and secularism and atheism answer, you know, in their own ways, those religious questions. They are not, again, they're not empirical, they're not rational, they're not scientific, they're metaphysical questions. So based on that, you know, atheism and secularism absolutely is a religion. And it's very obvious that it is a competing religion, especially when you look at, I mean, if you even, I mean, there's all kinds of examples of that. Some of them are really dramatic, right? Like communist China, an explicitly atheist government, and makes open war on all forms of faith, especially Christianity, but also including other faiths, such as against Buddhists and Muslims. And then there's, of course, not quite so obvious examples of that, but in American public life, the nuns, and we've talked about this before, Todd, but, you know, the younger, with each successive generation in the past 100 years of the United States, young people have become less Christian. And what they become when they're less Christian, some of them say that they're not anything, but for most of them, it's at least a passive atheism, agnosticism. And for some, it's a very active agnosticism. And it's becoming very, very true and obvious that those two ways of thinking about those the world, the way that you answer the question of whether there is a God and what kind of God he is, has a huge connection to how you behave, what your politics are, all these other ways that are more visible ways of acting. So, I mean, if you just look at American public life, the alternative to Christianity in the United States basically is atheism. And of course, you can't blame all of that on public education, but I do think that you can blame, you know, at least a portion of that on the fact that public education is actively now hostile to Christianity in a number of different ways. And one of the ways that it is hostile to Christianity is simply by pretending that they can be neutral about religion and never mentioning it, as if it's not the most important truth in the world, that there is not so much there that it requires faithful daily study from the time that you are a child, and, you know, that you can't separate it from everything else that you learn about the world, because whether God is true and real or not absolutely affects how you learn and study every single thing else.
Joy Pullman is managing editor of The Federalist. She is author of the book, The Education Invasion, and a recent column titled Supreme Court to Decide If Atheism Can Keep Its Monopoly on K-12 Schools. You can purchase The Education Invasion and read Joy's columns at issuesetc.org. Click Talk On Demand Archives. Joy, thanks.
Thank you.
When we come back from this break, it will be an update on the impeachment trial of President Donald Trump. Molly Hemingway of Fox News will be our guest. She has written recently about it, and we're going to find out what's going on in Washington, D.C. next.
Deaconesses are women trained to share the gospel of Jesus Christ through works of mercy, spiritual care, and teaching of the Christian faith. The word deaconess means servant. Find out more on how you can serve in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod through the vocation of deaconess at lcms.org/deaconess. Working in faith, laboring in love, remaining steadfast in the hope of our Lord Jesus Christ. LCMS Deaconess Ministry. lcms.org/deaconess.
What is the Lutheran Witness? Simple. It's a monthly magazine on faith and life, theology and culture that helps readers interpret the contemporary world from a Lutheran Christian perspective. Filled with expert insights, good writing, and inspiring stories, it also provides essential church information for LCMS members. What is the Lutheran Witness? Simple. It's the flagship periodical of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, and it has been for more than a century. Visit cph.org/witness to subscribe today.
Essential exercise for the Christian mind. You're listening to Issues Etc.
This is Pastor Philip Hauser with Lamb of God Lutheran Church in Papillion, Nebraska. We're faithful to the Lutheran confessions as recorded in the Book of Concord, and our services are traditional Eucharistic liturgies in accordance with the ancient texts Saturday evening and Sunday morning. If you're ever in Omaha, come visit us. We're on Lincoln Street between 84th and 96th in Papillion. Our website is lambofgodlcms.org.
Did you know that Luther Academy has been providing continuing education for confessional Lutheran pastors and laypeople worldwide for more than 20 years? Luther Academy publishes Logia, the Confessional Lutheran Dogmatics series, and Luther Digest. Find out more about Luther Academy and sign up to receive their free email newsletter at lutheracademy.com, lutheracademy.com, and like them on Facebook, facebook.com/Luther Academy.